Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The coronavirus caseload and the death toll continue to mount at home and abroad, with more than 210,000 Americans dead since the start of the pandemic. And President Trump is being treated for coronavirus, as well as is the First Lady and a number of senior Republican officials infected as well, prompting many to ask that if the president can catch the virus, anyone can. Lawmakers continue to negotiate a fourth $2.2 trillion stimulus package as airlines make good on their threats to cut workforce. Meanwhile, the administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration flew aboard Boeing's 737 MAX jetliner, but the airplane is not yet going back in the air. As he says, a little more work is necessary. Joining us to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy, not far from our Washington headquarters. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Vago.
Thanks, Vago. Always a pleasure.
Hello, Vago. Great to be back.
Great to have all of you on. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Okay. Ron, let's start off with you, but want to get everybody's take on this. The president is being treated at Walter Reed Hospital with among the best doctors on the planet, access to novel antibody and immune enhancing drugs. There are a number of GOP officials and lawmakers sick as well. Ron, your former governor, Chris Christie, has it, and he's in a hospital now as well. For some, this is sort of comeuppance for bad behavior, like minimizing the disease, rejecting masks and physical distancing, while others ask, you know, if the president can catch it, no matter how irresponsible, so can they, right? Because there is this assumption that people around the president get tested regularly, whereas average people don't. How does this translate into an impact in our corner of the ecosystem, especially for air travel, which has sort of been eking up a little bit? I mean, obviously not as fast as everybody would like to see, because the virus is having a resurgence, as we've heard, and we're going to hear again from Sash. I mean, you know, start us off on what you think this sort of tectonic development in the middle of a presidential campaign means.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just kick off and say, you know, whatever, like, you know, to the president, hope he heals, and with his wife, just, you wouldn't want to wish this on anybody.
No, and we've done that on the Friday roundtable as well. Oh. We wish the president and everybody anywhere who's afflicted with this disease to emerge from it as well as they can, as quickly as they can.
So I think a couple things, and this will be a debate on the street. I mean, it's already playing out a little bit this way. There's one side of the debate that says, hey, you know what, if the president could get this, anybody could get this, you know, maybe we have to be more careful. But the flip side is, if the president has this, then it's going to, you know, kind of increase, you know, turn up the gain, if you will, to 11 on the whole vaccination thing, if you will, in terms of, you know, distribution, vaccination origination, the whole nine yards. So it's, there's a little bit of back and forth in the investment community ultimately at what this is going to mean. So we'll see. The news hit the market when, I mean, the market was still open, and the market was a little weak on it, but not tremendously so. I mean, you know, the volatility we saw in the market wasn't outside of the volatility we have been seeing, but right. You know, the day kind of after the news broke, the market did sell off a bit. You know, the aerospace stocks have been, you know, like we've seen before. I mean, have been pretty volatile. One remark I might say about the aerospace stocks: you're seeing some differentiation in the investment community between different companies. You know, some companies are, you know, getting bids and trading at reasonably rich multiples, while some other companies aren't. And it's not always exactly clear why that's the case. But so, you know, there might be some, you know, technical stuff going on and some other things. One last comment I might make is I am starting to get more questions from investors on, when can we start thinking about these things, right? I mean, you know, how much worse can it get from here? And if we take a long-term view, you know, when is it maybe safe to put a toe in the water? And not that I'm saying that, you know, that's happening in broad terms, but I am starting to get some more questions on that from folks who are, you know, particularly maybe with a bunch of longer term view on the market.
Sash, why don't you give us your take? Your Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, was afflicted with coronavirus. He ended up in intensive care. Then again, Boris Johnson is younger than Donald Trump is, but you know, had the disease when there weren't those kind of therapeutics that were yet available. What's your take on how this is going to affect sort of public sentiment or any other factor?
Boris Johnson catching and being treated for coronavirus was a huge shock in the UK. It led to a rallying round because. You know, no matter what your political persuasion, it really is a shock when the political leader of the nation is taken ill so badly, so quickly. So there was a huge amount of sympathy for him, and normal politics pretty much stopped for the 2 weeks that he was in, or you know, week and a half that he was in hospital. And interestingly, even when he came out of hospital, it was probably another 3 weeks plus before he was able to start doing the Prime Minister stuff properly and in public. It really did lay him out very, very low indeed. And it was clearly a huge shock to him personally. I mean, there's an awful lot of comments that he made, and the fact that he then went on a sort of fitness kick and lost a lot of weight and has started sort of proselytizing about you've got to lose weight, because if you go into the hospital and you are overweight, and Boris Johnson was very overweight, it's going to really hurt you. So it was a big shock. There was a lot of sympathy for him from, you know, not in all political quarters, because people stopped being political about that. And it took a very, very long time for him to recover. So depending on how long how seriously ill President Trump has become, he may not be, you know, back and up and running for a significant period of time. And I think, you know, that was certainly our experience with Boris Johnson.
But how do you think, right? I mean, there were some people, though, at the time who did criticize him, right? I mean, he was minimizing the virus. He became much, much more mask wearing and right. I mean, and then pushed ahead with the lockdown and everything else after that. And I should also note that even though Boris Johnson is not the sveltest person, he is somebody who, despite his girth, has been extremely fit, right? He's an avid biker. He's an avid rugby player and a couple of other things. So, I mean,
I think he became he became very unfit when he became prime minister, because it's just hard to be fit in number 10 Downing Street. Number 10 Downing Street does not have the range and quality of facilities that your president has in the White House. So he lost fitness and he lost condition very, very badly indeed. It's, you know, leading a nation in that sort of way is not good for your health, to be perfectly clear. And you know, he clearly learned that lesson thereafter. But I would say he was very unfit when he became ill.
But how do you think this is? That was a nice little parenthetic discussion on the health of your prime minister, and I'm glad that he's much leaner than he was. But do you think that it's going to affect travel, right? I mean, an incident like this where so many prominent people take ill in such a short period of time, and the White House apparently has not been doing any contact tracing at this point. So we don't know how many people in the places where the president has held rallies, for example, are coming down ill as well. Although we have some reports that there might be some, you know, that others may have gotten sick as well. Do you think that that affects how, you know, does it affect the recovery? Does it affect
people? Of course it does. I mean, it affects the recovery. I mean, for one, because the level of coronavirus is so high in the United States that it will be on the red lists of almost any other nation in the world. And hence, until you get your number of cases per 100,000 of population down to 20 and below, almost any nation in the world that cares about these things, and that's most nations in the world, will insist that people who travel to the US go into quarantine when they come back, and quarantine typically 10 to 14 days. And as long as that is the case, international travel is dead. It's not a matter of airlines and aircraft manufacturers inventing, you know, fantastic new Perspex shields to sit in, or new ways of doing the air conditioning, or some ultraviolet magic Harry Potter wand, or some rubbish like that. It's about the fact that countries that are unhealthy will not be allowed to travel back from them without a quarantine that is so onerous that you won't go there in the first place. End of.
Richard, what's your sense on how all of this and what all of this means?
I'm afraid I completely disagree with Sash. This makes no difference whatsoever. If anything, it's a slight positive. I mean, look, you've got an administration that went out of its way, with all sympathy for the president and first lady, they went out of their way to say, no, even the most rudimentary of precautions are not necessary. As a matter of fact, they're a political badge of honor to eschew these very basic cautions. And now, okay, the consequence is a lot of people are infected with COVID-19. Boy, anyone who draws the conclusion that even the president can get this after this flaunting of even the most basic of protocols is completely out of luncheon. Probably not the sort of person who'd ever take a trip anyway. They probably live in a cave or something. And as for the idea that, well, the U.S. is going to be on a no-fly list, we're already on that. I mean, we can't go anywhere. The only thing I can say is that with a slight degree of hope is that maybe this makes us more serious as a country about obeying these very basic protocols, and that accelerates the return to something resembling normality. And, you know, I would hope that, you know, just taking these protocols would at least help somewhat. And God knows it's places that have been conspicuous by their refusal to obey in large numbers these protocols that have had the worst numbers, the Dakotas in particular. You know, everyone else has gotten it down to something manageable and at a European level.
Well, although I have to say that the figures are going up in some places, including in New York City.
Can I just make one point, which, sure, I realize is very difficult to understand for those of you in the US, but outside of the US, we do not make a distinction between the Dakotas and the Carolinas and Nevada and any other state. It's the United States of America, and I'm afraid we regard the whole place as being the same. And we look at the number of cases per 100,000 of population of the United States. And that's the metric off which all travel restrictions or lack of restrictions are based. And I think looking at things on a regional basis may make sense internally, politically, and in terms of dealing with the virus. Right. Nobody outside your country cares about the individual states, I'm afraid, just as you don't care about the difference between Lancashire and Cornwall in the UK.
I take that point completely. Right, I mean, a federal system for us makes a big deal, whereas for everybody else, it doesn't. Let's keep this moving a little bit, because I want to get your guys' sense on the next stimulus package. Ron, over the past couple of weeks, right, you've been talking, and all of us have been talking, about the market's view of the administration and Congress striking a deal to make some money available for airlines. Last week, or I should say week before last, we heard from American Airlines CEO Doug Parker, who said, hey, if we don't get $25 billion in federal aid by October 1, job cuts would happen. October 1 came and went, no deal, job cuts started happening. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, continues to negotiate with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and there is some optimism as Democrats in the House pass the slimmed down $2.2 trillion package that the Senate has yet to address. And now it's a little bit more complicated, because at least three senators have come to, GOP senators have come down with coronavirus. Where's the market's head on this at this point?
My sense is that, you know, the market was expecting something to come through for the airlines. Ultimately, if there is no package for the airlines, I would imagine that's going to be reflected in the stocks at this point. You know, and I guess I would rephrase. I don't see what the airlines are saying as a threat. It's just a fact, right? If they can't get the support, they can't keep the workforce. It's just that simple.
It's true, but it's great messaging as well, right? I mean, you said, like I said, hey, you know, if you don't give me the money, I'm going to fire people, and then you know when it happens, you start firing people. It's both heads up and it's also political pressure, right? I mean, CEOs now don't know how to play this game with lawmakers, especially you know in an election year, and I think that's one of the reasons why. You know, Democrats have come back to the table because even though you can say that the Republicans are being obstructionist, at the end of the day, there's still no deal and Democrats will end up getting hurt by this as well. So,
to answer the question, right, I do think there's still an expectation baked in on the street that something will come through. I think some folks were thinking you'd see it, you know, very late in the evening on right before the deadline. But you know, I think the market will be surprised if we don't have something by the end of this week.
Richard, what's your sense as somebody who's been watching these tea leaves very, very closely for any movement?
Yeah. I mean, I'm with Ron there. I mean, it's a simple matter of fact that a lot of these jobs are, you know, they're simply on life support. You remove the life support, you don't have the jobs. That's simple. And this is still an election year. I think they're going to find a way. It's not going to be a lot of margin for error, but I can't imagine that there won't be some kind skinny or slightly less than skinny, I hope, that a package like that won't be passed.
Sash, talk to us a little bit about how European governments and what the European government stimulus picture is, because I think it's been a couple of weeks since we've talked about what's going on your end, in your end of the universe.
I mean, actually, it's very, very piecemeal. There's nothing like the same focal point of the stimulus package that you've got in the US. And European governments tends to be reactive rather than actually trying to sort of get ahead of the issue. The individual airlines clearly have individual national identities. And in the case of the three big airline groups, they've each got 2, 3, 4 different home governments that they can play to. What we don't or haven't had is the same focus on you have to provide a bailout or else, you know, all the jobs get it. And I think that's because the European airline system is not quite as consolidated as the US airline system. And it's not quite as integrated as integrated an economy as the US airline system. So there are individual airlines that are actually performing okay, or at least they tell us they're performing okay and would like to perform better. Wizz Air, for example, which is a predominantly Eastern European or Eastern European-centered business, seems to be performing quite well. Ryanair always complains. You would expect to Ryanair always to complain. Virgin had its bailout a couple of weeks ago. I drove past London Heathrow yesterday. There's an awful lot of grounded aircraft there, and the terminals are very, very empty at the moment. But I don't think there is the same sort of pressure to get people flying, because more European airlines are focused on international transport, and governments realize and travelers realize there's no point in having airlines and supporting airlines if you can't fly internationally, because you're going to have to quarantine at the other end, or when you come back, or both. One point to the point that Ron made earlier on. I mean, Ron is clearly getting pretty similar in client calls to what we're getting, which is, you know, when is the trough? What companies can we actually start to look at and when? And we had a very, very interesting situation this week, which is that Rolls-Royce did a massive it was a complete recapitalization, a fully underwritten rights issue, massively dilutive, a government underwritten debt issue, and a whole lot more beside. And they're going to do some disposals and so forth. And the Rolls-Royce share price has fallen 91% from its 2014 high. We have finally, we agency partners have finally cut our sell recommendation. We've now got it on a hold. we haven't had Rolls-Royce so highly rated since 2006. We've missed a lot of the upside on the way up, but you know, when a share price falls that much and when it has had this big a recap, we're prepared to start looking at it again, which I think is really interesting. The problem is that we're not prepared to look at Airbus, Meggitt, Safran, MTU of the European names, because most of them have only halved. And they've probably got a halving again to go. There's been this disconnect between how badly Rolls-Royce has underperformed compared to relatively how well the other guys have performed in the last 3-4 months or so. So what we're telling investors is, hang on for the other guys. The only stock you want to be looking at, and it's a long-term look, is Rolls-Royce.
Thanks very much for bringing that up. And you're talking about the ecosystem, and I want to try to get to that, including build rates. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the 737 MAX, if that's okay. Steve Dixon, the administrator, FAA administrator, flew on the jet. It looks like we're moving toward getting the airplane back in service. There were some who looked at his flight as little more than a PR stunt. And there are lawmakers who are saying, hey, we want to see the FAA's data. There's nothing new there, wanting to be sure that this isn't a politically motivated or a kind of go economic decision, rather something that's based on sound engineering. Ron, as our resident engineer, right? I mean, where are we? And I don't know if we have to spend a lot of time talking about this, sort of because there was other Boeing news and Airbus news that we got to talk about, sort of where are we?
Yeah, I mean, having Dixon fly the aircraft, I mean, he is a pilot, right? And he's the figurehead of the FAA, right? So there's probably some value there, but ultimately, you know, I would be astonished if he was surprised on some level by what was going on the airplane, given all the flights and everything that led up to it. So, you know, is it a little bit of showmanship, probably, but also he is the head guy and his agency's got to sign off on it. And, you know, they got themselves in hot water last time. So, you know, ultimately the buck does stop with him. So, you know, I think that's what we read into it.
You know, in fairness to Dixon, right? I mean, it is good to have somebody who is a trained pilot, who is the head of the FAA at the end of the day, and certainly wished that that degree of engagement and involvement had been in the development phase of this program, and not just, unfortunately, after two tragic flights with the jet, ended up in what is an astonishing grounding that's had an incredible impact on Boeing. Speaking of Boeing, as expected, we've been talking for a long time about the expectation that the Chicago-based company is going to shift 787 production, or consolidate, I should say, 787 production in Charleston. And so the company announced the decision. 787 production will end at Everett. And it is consistent with the company's long-running strategy to sort of minimize its unionized workforce. Clearly doesn't bode well for Everett, right? 747 production is going to end in about 2 years' time. We've got a handful of 767s that are being made for the commercial freighter market, but as well to get roughly 1 point something a month are becoming KC 46 tankers for the Air Force, and obviously 777X. But of course, you know, we just talked about passenger air travel trends, right? That's not going anywhere fast, especially if we've got an even more, you know, as the pandemic worsens across international lines. And Everett is the world's largest manufacturing facility on the planet, not just aviation manufacturing facility, facility. So what happens here, Ron, right? I mean, so do you need to consolidate Renton? You know, does Boeing have to shut down Renton where it makes 737s and consolidate them into Everett to try to get better footprint? Or is it best to just shut down Everett and move elements of these production lines closer to Renton, right? I mean, at some point, once you make a decision like this and you have these kind of impacts, or is this something that's just carrying cost? You got to keep Everett open and alive, because if you do go back to higher rate production on big airplanes, although it's, you know, I mean, that facility was designed to be building 777s and 747s and 767s and 50s. I mean, right? I mean, it was designed to be building a lot of different things in volume all at the same time. And it doesn't look like we're ever going to get there again.
Well, a couple comments. I mean, one, never say never, right? I mean, will air traffic get back? We've talked about this a lot, right, at some point, right? So it will. I think there's some bigger strategic questions that Boeing hasn't answered yet that I presume somewhere they have answers or they're working on answers. Like you say, many of the programs that ever 7.4 will be ending, 7.6 is at low volume. And then you've got, you know, 777. 777X is at this point, I don't know, it's largely sort of a Middle Eastern airplane for the Middle Eastern airlines. And who knows ultimately what form they will take after the pandemic, right? So what do you do? You look at Renton, and I think, you know, Richard and Sasha would probably agree with this. They've both toured both facilities and maybe spent more time there. Renton's space constrained, right? I mean, I think one of the big issues that they've had about Renton is it's just so small. I mean, it's Renton, the city is kind of growing around it. And so, you know, do you keep Renton? Or I think the question is, do you move Renton to Everett? That's one. Two, are you going to do another airplane, right? I think, you know, there's a lot of forces at work saying, hey, you know what, Boeing, if you do another airplane, do it in Everett. You can imagine the IAM, for one, might want something like that. You know, what is Boeing thinking on that front? You know, the pullback in product development R&D that they're going through right now because of the pandemic, you know, how long will that last and that sort of thing. So there's some bigger strategic implications. And then finally, and I think we talked about this before, I really do worry about the workforce in Everett. I mean, you've got, it's a generational workforce, you know, fathers and sons, mothers and daughters have worked, you know, in that facility. And, you know, and once you lose that workforce, it's gone, right? So that's another consideration. So I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions, but I think ultimately you don't move Everett to Renton. It's, you know, do you move Renton to Everett because Renton's so space constrained?
Right. And that was sort of my expectation as well. And I couldn't endorse more the notion of, you know, an extremely high quality workforce. Although if you look at what's happened with KC-46, you might start questioning that, you know, fundamental reality, unfortunately, as well. Although the company does have, you know, their answer is, you know, we kind of shelved airplanes that were in production in order to make changes and, you know, et cetera. And we didn't quite, you know, that we're getting a handle and a bead on the problem. And I think the Air Force has said that as well. Richard, how do you see this all playing out? And the company claims that Charleston is big enough to maintain full load on 787, although, you know, there have been problems there as well. And Ron, if you could give us a kind of a quick update on where we are on 787 fuselage, you know, I mean, a couple of the challenges that we had would be great as well. But Richard, why don't you kind of start us off on where you see all these tea leaves falling?
Yeah, you know, I agree completely with Ron there. It makes a lot of sense to think about consolidating Renton to Everett, not the other way around. And certainly real estate values would also mitigate heavily against doing much with Everett at the to the benefit of Renton. You know, Renton's primary manufacturing is a job, in addition to putting together 737s, is manufacturing the wings. The fuselage is, of course, built in Wichita, Spirit Aerosystems. Right. I don't think it would be terribly easy, but on the other hand, not terribly catastrophic to move the facilities up to Everett. In terms of building a new plane, you know, it's one thing to ultimately do a transplant line with the 787s. Another thing to have the kind of traditional, and I think still necessary, combination of design and manufacture in the same place. Charleston simply doesn't have that kind of experienced design corps, sufficient number of engineers. If they're going to build a new plane, I think it just makes an awful lot of sense to keep it in the Puget Sound area. And that means to me, Everett, that's where you have the necessary, both real estate, engineers, manufacturers with experience, all in one place. It's the only really full service spot that makes sense. Assuming, of course, that Boeing does a new plane, which we all hope they do.
Sash, what's your sense looking at where Boeing is and this decision at the end of the day, its rationale and its long-term impact?
Really simple. Boeing has got to do a new aircraft. If they're not, the company continues down the trajectory that McDonnell Douglas went down. And that means it becomes irrelevant, not even in a generation, probably irrelevant within the decade. And having a weak narrow body and good wide bodies in a market that doesn't want wide bodies gets you to McDonnell Douglas really fast indeed. I don't know a single company in this industry that manages successfully to have their design teams in one place and they're manufacturing in another. You know, integration, physical integration of design and manufacture is what makes Western Aerospace work incredibly well. So I think, you know, any company that was any other company making these decisions would say the next generation aircraft's got to be built, and it's got to be built at Everett and not Renton.
Speaking about production rates really quickly, Ron, why don't you start us off on sort of Boeing's overall production rate and build down, right? And then Richard, kind of give us a sense on where Airbus is going as well. And actually the whole industry is going, right? I mean, we're seeing impacts, you know, not just at the two big, the big players as well.
Yeah, I would say on that front, and this is probably a good segue from our previous topic. On the 787 itself, you know, Boeing has said in 21, they'll be down at 6 per month. I don't think there's anybody who believes that outside of Boeing. Maybe they don't even believe it. I mean, everybody, you know, I talk to on the supply base and the investment community thinks that there's another step down from there. It's, you know, hard to say if it's 4 per month or 5 per month, but it's another step down. And the same thing with the ultimate delivery rates and production rates on 737s. That probably takes another step down. And you know, we'll probably hear that this quarter, next quarter, who knows when they'll come up with that, but that's probably where it's going to be. And on 777s, I mean, they're just going to kind of trickle out. And that's, you know, the situation. And I think that's what also makes this calculus around Charleston kind of interesting. Because if you're only making 4 of these airplanes a month, like really it makes a ton of sense to be at one facility, right?
Richard, what about Airbus and where they are in their build down and rates, because nobody really believes them as well.
Yeah, you know, and it's always been really tough to tell to what extent the buildup of inventory at Airbus was a function of, pandemic related logistical concerns, and how much was people saying, no, we don't want our jets. It's probably a function of both, really. But over the past month, there's been a nice reduction in the number of inventoried Airbus jets to the tune of about 15 or 20% less. I still think, you know, per Sash's comments, you know, there's going to be a day of reckoning with production rates, certainly with twin aisles. But when it comes to single aisles, there is the, I think, reasonable, maybe not majority, but reasonable chance that Airbus could perhaps hold the line with the current plan of 40 per month on the 320 family, you know, with the usual half a month off or 3 weeks off or whatever they allow for in Europe. But, you know, so that reduction definitely helps maybe it takes a little bit of pressure off. We still have it coming down to 30 for a time, but you know, they'll be able to point to this reduction in inventory as a positive sign. Unfortunately, twin aisles continue to see no such relief. So we regard another rate cut there as inevitable, both for both Airbus and Boeing.
Sash, you want to add anything to this, or do we want to move on to the Swiss player competition? No, go ahead.
There's quite an interesting issue of sort of timing and market psychology. And you and I think some of our listeners will remember we've referred to the game that Airbus and Boeing are playing as being sort of production chicken. Neither wants to cut production first because then the other guy wins. And there was a bit of evidence of that this week with a story on the wires that Boeing is approaching Delta, which is, you know, by far the strongest Airbus customer in North America. And Boeing's approaching Delta and saying, we want to sell you 40 737 MAX whitetails. And it's news like that, or, you know, reports like that, that is going to keep Airbus overproducing, you know, producing narrow bodies at 40 a month rather than Richard's 30 a month or R25 a month, because they cannot afford to let, in this case, Delta off the hook. They've got to be clear that, you know, Delta is contractually obliged to take however many aircraft it is, you know, each year. And if Delta wants to cancel those aircraft, that comes with penalties. But if Airbus cuts production first, then Delta can go back to them and say, hey, you were never able or willing to produce the aircraft that we were supposedly willing to take, and therefore we're let off the hook, and then we'll go and buy some really, really cheap 737 MAXes. So I think this story about Boeing approaching them to buy you know, a big slug of the Max Whitetails, really will confirm Airbus in their belief that they can't back down. They can't blink on rates quite yet. When they do blink, boy, we're going to know it.
You guys have anything you want to add to that before we hit our last two questions and wrap for the week? Ron, Richard, anything you want to add rate-wise?
Well, I guess the only thing I would add is, of course, all this talk about Ryanair going in for a cut rate year-end discount buy of MAXes, you know, that might also speak to Boeing's desire to simultaneously get 450 existing MAXes out the door while simultaneously ramping up to 20 per month on new production. It probably does take some kind of significant movement on the order front like that one to justify those decisions.
God, who would have imagined the world's most cut rate airline looking for a cut rate deal? Baffling.
Yeah, and one point I might add that I think is, you know, becoming more important when you hear about these airplanes being, you know, pushed into the market or being sold at discounted rate. What does it mean for residual values of the airplanes? What does it mean for the financing markets for aircraft? What does it mean for lessors who have the, you know, some flavor of these airplanes on their books, or, you know, will potentially take some of these airplanes? So, you know, this whole thing that we're talking about here has reverberations that can make its way out, you know, into the leasing community and financing community and everything else. So that's things that we have to keep an eye on. I mean, just to remind everybody, the 737 NG always had a good book value, right? When you looked at the values of the NG and you compared it to the A320, it always held a little bit better value. That, you know, most certainly is probably not the case anymore, at least for the MAX, for sure that's not the case. But, you know, it that's going to be an important consideration as things start to normalize some, how, you know, the broader aircraft financing community deals with these aircraft.
We've got two questions before we part for the week. Go to you, Sash. Obviously, we covered the Swiss fighter competition, national referendum, narrowly approving a replacement for the F-18. Obviously, the country also uses F-5 Tigers. But this is, and so there were a number of folks who were asking me, you know, why we didn't talk about the F-35, you know, sort of seeing this as an F-18, F-35 competition, in part because the Swiss bought the F-18 the last time around. And the F-35 is not the airplane that this requirement is pretty much engineered toward, right? Switzerland is a neutral nation. It needs an air defense airplane. It's not abundantly clear that it needs a sophisticated strike jet, which is what you get with the F-35, even though it can do a number of other missions. It really is optimized for the strike role. Talk to us a little bit about the requirement and how the Patriot missile competition, right? Because Switzerland is also interested in an air defense package, and how all of these different themes and elements are coming together in this competition.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I loved your English understatement of it's not entirely clear about the F-35.
I've been friends with you for a long time.
No. I hugely appreciate the compliment. It's hugely clear. This is not a contest that the F-35 is optimized for, and the ground has been shifting massively away from the F-35 even in the last week. It's very interesting when you start to look at the comments coming in the Swiss press, French or German language. I haven't looked at the Italian language, but that is a minority even in Switzerland. Following the referendum, there's a real very, very strong view that, yes, the referendum passed, which is a huge huge improvement compared to last time, but it was so narrow that there is no mandate for an expensive aircraft like the F-35 compared to an aircraft that is good enough at the price for which read Rafale or F-18. Second issue. The Swiss requirement is first and foremost air policing. It's not strike. So an aircraft with strike in its name isn't doing the job the Swiss want. You know, the Swiss need an aircraft that can operate dispersed, that can do a quick response role without the engine running within, 2 to 3 minutes. And the F-35 can't do that. Lockheed Martin's admitted in the trials the F-35 can't do that. But the QRA role, which is something that the Europeans are very used to, and the, you know, the U.S. Air Force does to, you know, very impressively in Alaska. But the QRA role requires fantastic availability and the ability to, you know, sortie very, very fast indeed. So we're coming down to F-18 versus Rafale. Why do I think this is Rafale's to lose? The Swiss-French alignment has gone stronger and stronger. And we talked about this before, particularly right. during coronavirus. Second issue, the French paid the Swiss the most fantastic politico-military compliment in the last week or so by creating an air policing brigade, which will deal with all the issues of air policing by the French armed forces. But they specifically modeled it on the way that the Swiss do it. And so that what the French are saying is, we need to learn from you. And by the way, you can buy our aircraft and we'll learn even more from you and we'll do this whole thing together. That sort of thing does not go unnoticed in Switzerland. And so you've got these politicians on the one hand saying the referendum was too narrow for us to afford anything other than the most affordable aircraft. And look at the compliment that we're being paid by France. This shows this is the nation we should be working with. I think F-35 is absolutely dead. The question is whether F-18 has a chance or not. Final point, DSCA notifications. Where
the Defense Security agency, Cooperation Agency in Cooperation Washington agency, that does overseas arms sales.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, they publish these incredibly unhelpful notices that say country X is going to buy loads of whatever it is, you know, aircraft, tanks, guns, and the cost is Y, where Y is a very large number. They published one of those for the Swiss requirement, the F-35s, and that frightened the politicians big time. But they also published one for the possible sale of Patriot because the Swiss have got an air defense missile requirement. And the Swiss reaction, again, you just see this in the press. And remember, if you do a Venn diagram of Swiss politicians compared to Swiss military, Swiss bankers compared to Swiss military, that Venn diagram is just a single circle because it's completely overlapping. So when you hear Swiss politicians saying the DSCA numbers mean we're going to get 2/3 of the firing posts that we need for 50% more than we budgeted for, that tells you how it's being judged by the Swiss military. So Raytheon have really got to sharpen their pencil. Otherwise, they're out. And in that case, it'll be a French clean sweep, in my humble opinion.
And I should also note that it was, I believe, well, it was a jet over Paris that broke the sound barrier that was alerted to intercept an air contact last week, if I recall correctly. I'm not drawing any line between these two events, but just merely pointing that out because...
I think actually it's very important. This shows how air police, you know, what air policing is in Europe right. at the moment, which is it's tracking down aircraft which, for whatever reason, have stopped squawking on their transponders or where their radio's broken or where they've right. strayed away from their air traffic control route. We had a similar situation with two Eurofighter Typhoons going supersonic over London last year. It's pretty impressive stuff. It's great, but it does. You know, this is the requirement. It's the baseline requirement for fighter aircraft at the moment.
We are getting perilously over time. Richard, do you want to add anything to that? And Ron, I've got a quick question I've got to ask you before we part.
You know, back in simpler times, we'd have gone to eBay and tried to find a model of an F-35 with Swiss markings just for a laugh later in life. You know, like, that is hilarious. I mean, it's a plane designed to kick down the door, you know, to Liechtenstein, you know, many big questions. But I'd also point out that DSCA seems to be going a bit overboard with these notifications. Earlier this year, of course, the legendary Indonesian V-22s, which, of course, that's a sale that has the same chances as, you know, Snowball in Jakarta. Just a bizarre idea.
Yeah, wasn't there something odd to Malaysia as well on that, or was it just Indonesia?
Well, the Philippines were notified with both the
that's right.
Apaches and Cobra Zulus, which, you know, none of the above, bizarre idea.
Ron, very quickly, the one U.S. budgeting item that is new is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, said that, hey, look, there is bipartisan support for defense and to, you know, make sure that there aren't defense cuts, but the progressive wing of the party is likely to push hard for cuts. There's this sense that if Democrats win and Republicans are in the minority, All of a sudden, debt reduction will be something important. The party finds religion anytime there's a Democrat in the White House. And so that could end up putting pressure on defense as well. Did Adam Smith's comments resonate at all on Wall Street last week? And is that now playing into people's mindset that defense might be up for a haircut, especially, you know, if you're looking at $2.2 trillion you're going to do now, and former Vice President Biden, who is ahead in the polls, obviously no guarantee that he's going to win, you know, is saying, look, we also need another big stimulus package to push us, to address some of these financial issues in the wake of the pandemic. Are these sort of moving any needles for investors at this point?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you look at where the defense stocks have performed this year, relative to the market, relative to themselves, their valuations, they're trading in a range right now that is, you know, presupposing some level of cuts in defense. You know, the questions become, you know, what gets cut, where, what's at risk, so on and so forth. But yeah, you know, I'd say for sure, if you look at how defense has performed, up to this period, that's sure in the consciousness of the market. And in fact, I think, you know, the conversations I've had with investors lately, I mean, are kind of similar to those on commercial, in that, you know, these are kind of beat up. You know, how bad does it really have to be to justify what's happened with the defense stocks, right? So that's kind of where we are, Bago, right? I mean, so, yeah.
Right. All right, guys. Thanks very, very much. Really appreciate it. Looking forward to having you back on next week. In the meantime, have a great week.
Thanks, Bago.
Thanks, Bago. Always a pleasure.
Always great to be here, Bago. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.